Welcome back to the Rav Hirsch on Parsha series on OU Torah. This week we will begin studying Rav Hirsch's commentary to Sefer Bamidbar. And at the very beginning of the Sefer, Rav Hirsch draws a contrast between Sefer Vayikra and Sefer Bamidbar and connects the two and shows how and writes the Sefer Vayikra is really devoted to the ideal standards to which the Jewish nation is to aim for. And it's expressed, and these ideals are expressed symbolically through the Mikdash. And Sefer Vayikra is full of karbanos and the halachos regarding the Mikdash. And as well as in Kedoshim, we find the mitzvos that are meant to sanctify the Jewish people, bringing the ideal of the Mikdash into everyday life. So the Sefer is Vayikra as a whole provides a description of the ideal both in symbol and in practice of what the Jewish people should be striving toward. And dedicating how the Jewish people should dedicate themselves to Hashem. In Sefer Bamidbar, we return to the reality of Jewish life. And now it's a matter of describing how the people lived and how they translated those ideals into their lives and how they aim to reach those goals. He draws a contrast between the end of Sefer Vayikra, where at the end of last week's parsha B'chukosai, the parsha describes Nidre Hektish, when a person makes a vow to devote himself and that which belongs to him and give it and sanctify it and give it to the property of the Mikdash. And here, meaning it's symbolic of a person who's trying to devote everything, who devotes everything that he has to Hashem. And here in Bamidbar, we're going to read about how that was translated into their daily lives. And the beginning of this translation into their actual existence is through a counting, a census of the nation. And the purpose of the census showed that this concept of the ideals of the Jewish community was not just an abstract theoretical ideal, but it was something that was meant to be accomplished by the totality of the members. And every individual counted, and every individual served a purpose in reaching the ideal that the nation was striving toward, as described in Sefer Vayikra. Every individual was an important part of the community, and that the task of Kedoshim Tiyu, which was given to the nation as a whole, requires the participation of every single individual, and every person has a part to play in this national task. The way in which the people were counted is symbolic of the different tasks that every individual had and the different qualities that every individual brought to the table. And this diversity within qualities is something that Rav Hirsch comments on elsewhere, but he makes note of it here as well. We find that Hashem tells Moshe in the second pasuk of the parsha, he says, "Su'u es rosh kol adas b'nei Yisrael," to count, right, lift up the heads of all the community of B'nai Yisrael. L'mishpachosam, l'veisavosam, by their families, by their father's homes. L'mispar shemos, by the number of their names. Kol zochor l'gugulosam, every male, according to their heads. And what we see here is that Moshe is counting kol adas B'nai Yisrael, the entire Jewish nation, but he's also counting l'mishpachosam, l'veisavosam, by their families, by their ancestral homes, by their patriarchal homes. And Rav Hirsch says that we find everywhere, that in other places as well, that the Jewish nation is referred to as B'nai Yisrael. We are the children of Yisrael. We are all the children of one man, of Yaakov Avinu. And we are one unified nation. because we have one singular purpose, the mission of Yaakov Avinu, the mission of serving Hashem, and the Torah provides us with the means to do so. However, it is still important that we retain our individual identities of mishpachosam and beis avosam, of families, of tribal affiliations, of individual families and those their members, because the diversity of qualities that are unique to each family and each tribe are means to attain this goal. There's, and we discussed this in Parashas Vayechi, especially, which is where Yaakov gives a special bracha to each shevet, and there we see that there's one goal that we all share as Bnei Yisrael, but there are different ways of achieving that goal, and we need the contributions of each track and each path towards that goal to bring together the diversity of all Klal Yisrael together, so that Hashem can be served in all these many different ways, and together we can with every single person's contribution, every single family's contribution, we will be able to accomplish the goal that Hashem set for us as a nation. So when these hundreds of thousands of Jewish people are counted here, they are counted by their family groups, mishpachosam leveis avosam. But then together we get a single count of the nation as a whole, because every person has an important role in his family. And the family is an important component of the Jewish nation, but the nation as a whole also has this one singular purpose. So that's why Moshe Rabbeinu is commanded to count Bnei Yisrael, but by families. And each individual person is counted by name as well, because within each family, every single individual has an important role to play. And this is one of the primary features of this census, is that every individual is counted, not just counted as a number, but as a name, but mispar shemos, by the number of names. He would report to Moshe and Aaron and to the Nesiim as by name, by his name and his father's name and this family and this shevet, and then he would be with that proof and that self-identification, he would then be added to the tally of the Jewish nation as a whole. Because it was as a member of a specific family and with his individual qualities as a person, with his unique name, that was his key to membership in the Jewish people. So we see that how the balance of the family and the national membership and the individual personality all come together to contribute to the national goal of serving Hashem. And it's not that a person has to nullify his own personality to those national ideals, but that the diversity is important and that each individual has an important part to play. The result of this census was then translated into a method of encampment in the Midbar. And we read in the second parak how each shevet was assigned a particular location. But this location is relative to the Mishkan. When each shevet was assigned a place, when they as they reached their destination every step of the way in the Midbar, it was only when the Mishkan came to, when the Aron came to rest and the Mishkan was erected around it, at that point, relative to the Mishkan, every shevet had a station, right? So there was Machane Yehuda on the east, and Machane Reuven on the south, and Machane Ephraim on the west, and Machane Dan on the north, but it was all relative to the Mishkan. And this also symbolizes the idea that we've been discussing, how each shevet had their own unique talents. And there is a diversity of characteristics among the Jewish people, but they were all meant to be different ways of reaching this identical goal. So the idea is that each shevet is positioned in a different place in their encampment, but each one's location is relative to the same focal point. being the Olamoe, the Mishkan, the representative of the Torah in the middle. The Torah is the unifying element that brings that diversity together to serve a single purpose. And everyone's place was relative to the Torah. The Torah was the identifying feature in every person's home. It was the anchor of each person's life. Everybody knew where he was. Everybody felt at home. Everyone felt a place of rest relative to the Torah, the Aron, the Mishkan. That was how a person identified where he belonged, right? So Yehuda belonged on the east side of the Mishkan, and Reuven belonged on the south side of the Mishkan, but it was the Mishkan that served as the central point of focus in Jewish life, and that brought all the diverse Shevatim together because they all shared that same feature. However, we read in Perek Beis, Pasuk Beis, that the encampment was not directly around the Mishkan. They did not ring the Mishkan in close proximity. But we read in Perek Beis, Pasuk Beis, Ish al diglova osos leves avosam. Each man, by his flag, with the emblems for their father's homes, Yachanu b'nei Yisrael, that's where the Jewish people would camp. Mineged, saviv lo'omo'ed yachanu. Mineged means at a distance, from a bit removed, but around the Olmo'ed they would camp. So they were not directly around, they were at a distance because the Levium were in between. And Rav Hirsch here cites the Ramban, who notes that in his Hakdama to Sefer Bamidbar, that there is a parallel between the Machanos around the Mishkan and the position of Klal Yisrael at Matan Torah. And this makes sense because we know that the Mishkan was a perpetuation of the experience of Matan Torah. The Aron represented the Torah itself, and the Jewish people lived around the Mishkan in a sense the same way they ringed Har Sinai when the Torah was given. And the Ramban, Rav Hirsch says, brings a pasuk from Tehillim, Kapitel Samachas, which says, Hashem bam Sinai ba'kodesh. Hashem is in their midst. Sinai is in the sanctuary. In other words, the Aron is meant to be an everlasting reminder of Sinai. And so similar to Sinai, the Jewish people were around the Torah at the focal point, but not directly. Because we know that at Matan Torah there was Hagbalah. The mountain was cordoned off, and the people were not permitted to approach the mountain. So here too with the Mishkan is cordoned off in a sense. The people are not permitted to approach the Mishkan. Only the Levim and the Kohanim, they camp directly around the Mishkan itself. They are the ones who perform the Avodah in the Mishkan. But for the regular people, they are not permitted to approach the Mishkan at any given time. And this symbolizes the same thing that the Hagbalah at Matan Torah symbolized, as we discussed in the Shir and Parashas Yisro, and Rav Hirsch mentions here again, the idea being that the Torah does not come from the people, but was given to the people, and the people are at a distance while the Torah is brought to them. And this contradicts any idea that Torah was invented by the Jewish people, and that it came from among them. Rather, they stood at a distance as it was delivered to them. And so here too, in the encampment, the Jews camped around the Mishkan, with the Mishkan at the focal point in the middle of it all, but they were not directly there. They were not directly at the Mishkan, but they stood at a distance with their thoughts turned toward the Mishkan, understanding its role at the center of their lives. And this was reverse right. This was particularly necessary at this point in time because this is again, the Mishkan was built after the Chet HaEgel, and now these instructions about the encampment are taking place following the census, and the census takes place and in Chodesh Iyar of the second year. We know that Chodesh Nisan of the second year, where it was when the Mishkan was dedicated. And so that was the final kapara for the Chet HaEgel. Now, a month later, we receive instructions about how to camp, and the encampment is set up in such a way that it reminds us of HaHagbolat Matan Torah, because the mistake of the Egel, Rav Hirsch writes, was forgetting the lesson of the Hagbalah. Because the lesson of the Hagbalah was that Torah does not come from the people, Torah comes from Hashem, and it is something given to us. It is an objective set of code of behavior that is given to us from on high. And when it came to the Chet HaEgel, the mistake was, and we discussed this briefly in our Shir in Parsha Kisisa, the mistake was that they wanted to choose a replacement for Moshe. They wanted to they took it in their own hands to find a divine representative for themselves in place of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is something that had they remembered the Hagbalah, the lessons of it, they would not have made that mistake. And so the Hagbalah is reinforced now in the wake of the Egel Hazav. It's reinforced by placing the Jewish camp Mineged Saviv L'Ohel Moed. It's around the Ohel Moed, but at a distance, reminding them that they do not have the ability to approach the Mishkan on their own, but it is something that is that comes to them through an intermediary, through Lakon and Levim, just as the Torah comes to them, or was given to them through Moshe Rabbeinu, but it comes from on high. It does not come from among them. At the end of the section about the various machanos and which shvatim were grouped where, Rav Hirsch goes through the whole list and shows that the diversity of Klal Yisrael was grouped different into these four distinct units of machanos in a very specific way. He shows how the leader is Machane Yehuda, composed of the Shvatim of Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun. And in this machane, Rav Hirsch writes, is encompassed both the physical and the spiritual strengths of the Jewish people, Yehuda being the leader, the king. And this section of Rav Hirsch's commentary is based primarily on his explanation of the brachos of Yaakov, which is where Rav Hirsch draws his understanding of the unique talents of each individual shevet. So Yehuda is, of course, the king, the royalty. Yisachar, as we discussed in our Shir on Vayechi, was an agrarian shevet, which their focus on working the land left them time to excel in scholarship and in learning. And Zvulun was a tribe of commerce. And so this grouping of three shvatim encapsulated really everything: the commerce, the working the land, but at the same time the scholarship and the royalty. And it all came together in this one camp, and that's why this camp served as the leader. But then on their right and their left were two camps of shvatim, which focused on one of these two aspects. Both the spiritual and the material. On the right side of Shevet Yehuda, of Machane Yehuda, was Machane Reuven, which was composed of Reuven, Shimon, and Gad. And Rav Hirsch says that these shvatim were focused on physical strength and defending against all attackers. Reuven was Pachas Kamayim, is someone who's quick and focused on justice, and has a sense of justice to right any wrongs. Shimon is, of course, the one who avenged his sister in Shechem, and God is God Gedud Yigudenu, is also associated with troops, with an army, and so these represent a concentration of physical strength, and Rav Hirsch writes they are placed at Yehuda's right hand because the leadership of Yehuda tempers the strength and the aggressiveness of these shvatim and uses them appropriately. On the left side of Machane Yehuda is Machane Dan in the north, and Machane Dan is done. Asher Naphtali, and here Rav Hirsch says these are shvatim that excel in what Rav Hirsch calls spiritual creativity. Dan is done. Yodin Amo is associated with the Nachash, is associated with Chachma. Asher is associated with a refinement of taste, Rav Hirsch says, because we know Me Asher Shmei No Lachmo V'Hu Yitain Ma Dan Emelech. So it's refined shevet. And Naphtali is associated with Hanosein Imrei Shofar, with speaking words of Torah, words of wisdom. So here we have more of a spiritual side, and again, that's placed just at the side of Yehuda in his service. We have the concentration of the physical and the concentration of the spiritual on either side of Yehuda, whose machane is a blend of both. And in the back, on the behind Yehuda, bringing up the rear, and Rav Hirsch doesn't discuss this directly, but we know there's a machlokas in Chazal as to how exactly these machanos traveled in the Midbar, whether they traveled in a straight line, such that we know they camped in a rectangle. They camped in all around the Mishkan. The question is, do they move in that way? When the camps traveled, did they all move in a coordinated manner such that Yehuda remained in the front, Reuven and Dan at the sides, and Ephraim in the back? Or when they moved, did they straighten out such that they formed a single file line with Yehuda in front, followed by behind him was Reuven with the Mishkan in the middle, followed by Ephraim, and then Dan bring up the rear? So this picture that Rav Hirsch draws here would seem to fit best with the opinion that they traveled in the same way that they camped, in a coordinated manner in this rectangular shape. In any case, Rav Hirsch says that behind Yehuda is Shevet Ephraim, and Shevet Machane Ephraim consists of Ephraim, Menashe, and Binyamin. And Rav Hirsch says that though we don't know much about Ephraim and Menashe's primary qualities, because the bracha given to Yosef in Vayechi is very much a personal bracha to Yosef himself, and less portending the future for his descendants, as Yaakov's bracha was for most of the other Shevatim. However, we know that Yaakov did say about Ephraim, Rav Hirsch says that Zaro Yemlo Hagoyim, that his descendants will fill the nations, and Rav Hirsch says that this means that he will reinforce the defenses of the other Shvatim. He will fill Meloha Goyim, fill up for the other tribes. And so, based on this association, Rav Hirsch says that all the Shvatim in this grouping probably were strong warriors who were courageous and provided that protection for the other Shvatim. They had the strength and the courage and protected the nation. And he brings a proof to this from a pasuk in Tehillim in Kapitel Pei, where there it says, Lifnei Ephraim uVinyamin uMenashe Oraros Gevurasecha. Before Ephraim, Binyamin, and Menashe, arouse your strength, L'chol Yishu Asolanu, and go be a salvation for us. And so we see that the salvation comes forth from Ephraim, Binyamin, and Menashe. It's a strange grouping. The only time we find these Shvatim put together is here by the Machanos in the Midbar. So it seems that that's what they would symbolize, bringing up the rear, protection, and having the courage to reinforce everyone else. However, the reverse notes that this role of Ephraim, of reinforcing the other Shevatim, reinforcing the rulership of Yehuda and complimenting him from the opposite side, later on in history, Ephraim would reject this role and you try to usurp the crown from Yehuda himself. And this is where we had the breakup of the kingdom between the two tribes and the ten, with most of the kings coming from Ephraim, such as Yoram ben Nevat. The first of the kings of Malchus Yisrael is called Malchus Ephraim. So Malchus Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, which is meant to reinforce and protect the Malchus of Yehuda, eventually they tried to take that away for themselves. But the reason why is because they already had a proclivity towards rulership, that their primary role was in the service of Yehuda to protect him from the others, from the opposite side. So we see here, Rav Hirsch draws a picture of the relationships of the different machanos to one another, and he points to the Midrash, and he refers the reader to the Midrash, where the Midrash provides other explanations of how the machanos are in alignment with the national, each tribe's responsibilities in the big picture of the nation as a whole. But this is one way in which he outlines the alignments of the machanos and why it was done in the just this way. In Perek Gimel, we read about the counting of the Levim, and our first notes that the Levim were not counted together with the rest of the Jewish people because they had a different calling. They were separated out. They had a separate task. In fact, he says that the Levim are listed here almost like a mini B'nai Yisrael, like a microcosm of the entire Jewish people. Just as the Jewish people had Mishpachosam and Beis Avosam, so Shevet Levi also has Mishpachosam, Beis Avosam. It's broken down by Gershon, Kehasa, and Merari are the Mishpachos, almost like the Shevatim in Klal Yisrael. You have three families within Levi, and each of those families is broken down to Batei Avos, as we can count the children of Gershon, the children of Kehas, and children of Merari, and it's almost like a smaller version of the Jewish people as a whole, because Levi is taken to have their own specific destiny and their own specific responsibilities, and so they are counted almost like a nation in their own right. How the primary difference is, of course, that Levim were counted from the age of 1 month, miben chodesh v'ma'alo tifkedim. Moshe Rabbeinu's command to count the Levim from the age of 1 month rather than the age of 20 years, as was the case with the rest of the Jewish people. And Rav Hirsch says this teaches us that the responsibilities of the Levim went beyond just their work in the Mishkan. The work in the Mishkan was we have a separate count at the end of the parasha, which begins at the end of the parasha and continues into next week's parasha, regarding who was fit to serve in the Mishkan from the tribe of Levi, and that count was done from the age of 30, and that's a separate counting. And so that it seems that is just one task of the Shevet Levi, but the primary task was something that they were already inducted into from the age of 1 month. And Rav Hirsch says that this is the responsibility of Shevet Levi, they weren't just entrusted with protecting the Mishkan and the work in the Mishkan, the symbolic representation of the Torah, but they were responsible for the guarding and teaching of the Torah itself and defending the observance of the Torah among the Jewish people. And they weren't just tasked with being in charge of the symbol of the Torah, but they were meant to bring the Torah to life among the people as teachers and as role models to all the other tribes. And this responsibility of the Levim was already part of their identity from the age of 1 month, because from the moment when the child became aware of its surroundings, from the moment where we can be sure the child will live, already then, it was a responsibility to train this child to be a Levi, to train him for his calling as a representative of Torah, as a teacher of Torah. And he had to be, throughout even childhood and infancy already, the training of this child must be done with his task in life in mind. And it's just an interesting idea that to be a teacher of Torah, to be a role model of Torah, that that task begins in already from infancy. And I would just refer the reader to the listener to an essay Rav Hirsch has in the collected writings, I believe in the volume on education, the seventh volume, in which Rav Hirsch addresses himself to a mother of a small child, and the mother wants to know what is she supposed to be doing to educate her child in his first year of life as an infant. And there Hirsch outlines what the parents' responsibilities to the child are, how parents can already from infancy begin to train their children for a life of Torah. And it's a long essay, but I refer the listener there for what exactly Hirsch has in mind when he talks about the training for a Levi beginning at the age of 1 month. Finally, one last small thought that I want to share with you from the very end of the parasha. The last parak of the parasha, Parak Dalet, deals with the responsibility of the family of Kehas in the Mishkan, and there they were charged with carrying all the main vessels in the Mishkan, and the parasha describes how each of the kelim were covered with a special cover, and then the Bnei Kehas would carry them. And at the very end of the parasha, in Parak Dalet, Pasuk Yud, Pasuk Chaf, the very last Pasuk in the parasha, we are told, Lo Yavo Liros. Well, actually, we read back Parak Dalet, Pasuk Yud Tes. V'zos asu lahem v'chayu lo yimusu. This you shall do for the members of Kehas, that they shall live and not die. V'gishtam es Kodesh Kodeshim, when they approach the Kodesh Kodeshim. Aaron uvanav yavohu. Aaron and his children shall approach. V'samu osam ish al avodoso v'amaso. And Aaron and his sons shall assign each one to his job and to that which he will carry. But they should not come approach to see as the sacred items are covered up, for if they do so, they shall die. There is a lav in the Torah based on these psukim for the Bnei Kehas to enter the Mishkan and witness the covering up of the kelim. Why is this so? Why? What's the reason for this? So Rav Hirsch explains that because this would take away from the symbolism, the powerful symbolism of the kelim in the Mishkan, which we spend much time on in Sefer Shemos, and we keep coming back to it every so often. But we know the Mishkan was meant to provide powerful symbols and lessons in life. And Rav Hirsch says that these kelim are primarily meant to be, he said the kelim are primarily meant to be a subject for thought and not an object of physical sight. He writes, the bearers of the sanctuary should direct their minds to it, not feast their eyes on it. They should contemplate the meaning of the sanctuary and not divert their attention from this meaning. This is an essential aspect of their duties. Hence, to feast their eyes on the sanctuary during the covering would be to desecrate it in their hearts. And so he says that it's not meant to be, the kelim are not meant so that we can admire the craftsmanship and the fine artwork and the way in which it's made. That would detract from the symbolism and the way we're supposed to conceive of it in our minds. Yes, it's something that exists. It's something that's a physical reality, and it's an actual object that was created. But the focus should not be on looking at it and admiring it. The focus should be on our conception of it and our ability to draw lessons for life from it. And so the Levim who carried these kelim were not permitted to see them before they transported them, but rather they were covered up, and then the Kohanim would invite them in and assign them to carry whatever it was they were to carry while it remained covered up. And this is an important idea, because we've been discussing constantly the symbolism of this and the symbolism of that, and reverse shows from here that that's almost the most important thing when it comes to the Mishkan, is the symbolism, is the ideas. It's not the nitty-gritty of the Avoda itself, or how beautiful it is, whatever it might be. It's the ideas that are conveyed to us through the Avoda, through the construction of the Mishkan. That's the most important thing, and we must be careful not to allow the our viewing of the Kalim themselves to distract us from the from contemplating the lessons that they are meant to give to us, which is their primary function.